Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com.
Welcome back to Current State. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up later in the hour, Lieutenant Governor Brian Calley joins us, along with Jane Turner, who's a member of the Michigan Autism Council, to talk about the changes in store regarding autism here in the state of Michigan, and more specifically, insurance for autism disorders in the state. And we also talk about the interesting, the nexus between energy and water in the state of Michigan. That is all coming up here today on Current State. But at the top here, one Detroit reporter once referred in print to our next guest as the most influential person in Michigan you never heard of. Since the 1960s, Lansing-based attorney Richard McClellan's imprint is found on a wide range of Michigan policy, from education to the judiciary to telecommunications, energy, and other fields. The Republican has also been active nationally and internationally for close to 40 years in West African affairs. There, he's been especially involved in infrastructure development and the often turbulent politics of the region. He's also a graduate of Michigan State University and has been an adjunct professor here at MSU. Richard McClellan, welcome to Current State.
Morning, Mark.
You began your working life in the Capitol building, you told me, in 1963. As a janitor. Pretty modest beginnings for someone who went on to become, as some people put it at the time, the Darth Vader of the John Engler administration.
That is accurate. All those are accurate.
talk about this trajectory from janitor to policy heavyweight.
I was a janitor in 1963 in the House. They were kind of political plums, and through a complicated story involving former President McPherson of MSU, who was a janitor in the Senate, I got a janitor job. Then in 65, I got a summer job as a driver for then Lieutenant Governor Milliken. And then in 66, I got involved again during the campaign. 69, when Governor Milliken became governor, I went on his policy staff for 4 years.
Okay.
And then I just continued basically I moved across the street, opened a law office, and focused on public policy for the next 40 years.
I'm not sure anyone knew until this moment that Peter McPherson was a janitor at the state capitol, too. So,
yes, he was.
So those were political plums, as
yes,
you put
they
it.
Were.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your politics were already formed as a young guy, or did rubbing shoulders with William Milliken? And did you know George Romney?
Yes, I knew George Romney. I knew Soapy Williams. I knew John Swainson, Governor Swainson.
Okay.
Was a friend of my father's. I was, 1960, I was a Republican. In my town, Pawpaw, Michigan, I remember they had a teacher that had a little donkey pin on her, and I said, "What's that for?" And she says, "Well, I'm a Democrat." And I said, "Well, I thought to myself, well, I think it's okay to be a Democrat, but I didn't think they should let him teach in schools." It shows you the kind of community I came from. My grandmother said she'd vote for the devil if he was on the Republican ticket. So my roots were clear, but I've always been sort of a libertarian Republican for pretty much my whole political life.
Interesting. You've been working on education issues for the Snyder administration for some time. Tell us about the focus of your work there.
Well, Governor Snyder, when he took over in 2011, issued a message on education where he called about reinventing public education and breaking the status quo and allowing money to follow the child rather than being locked into the school districts. It was quite dramatic. And then he eventually asked me to rewrite the School Aid Act to accommodate those new public policies. And that's what I've been doing for over a year now. And Actually, I'm going to meet over with his staff this week, and we've been moving ahead on that. I also was asked to get involved in the Detroit Public Schools issue and the creation of the Education Achievement Authority and a number of things. So I really, the last 2 years, I've been quite heavily involved as a volunteer helping the governor on this education policy.
What's that been like? I mean, go a little deeper here with us, if you would.
Well, one thing I learned is that the public education system is a very heavily regulated industry. It employs over 300,000 people in the state. It's very rigid. It's based on a 1920s factory model, is the way our education system is created. Kind of school I went to, maybe you went to too. And to change it is very difficult because it is very resistant to change. And having been assigned by the governor to address change, it has caused quite a bit of consternation among the existing school system. And so the governor really has to make some choices. He, this month, has his education summit where I think some of these issues will come out. I've been just doing basically volunteer staff work, but because of my unsavory background in the voucher issue, it's caused a lot of of controversy.
Is there a scenario then where you would support either limited or full vouchers?
If in terms of my present assignment, I'm only working on the governor's policies.
Okay.
And there's nothing involved. Number one, it's constitutionally prohibited. Number three, it's been voted on by the people 4 times in the state with wider and wider margins. I think the voters of this state do not believe that their taxpayer dollars should go to pay for religious schools. It's just one of those fundamental things that I think a majority of the people oppose. Even though vouchers for private schools is developing all over the country as a way to try to address these failing schools, particularly urban schools. But it's not part of the governor's agenda. It's not part of my agenda. And I don't think it's really a relevant issue in the state of Michigan. It keeps being brought up by some of the education people, I think just as a straw man to beat up because they don't want any change. And so the voucher is the most toxic word you can raise within the public education industry.
Hot button word.
It's a hot button word. And therefore, if you throw it out, it gets people worked up.
You are what do you make of the actual arguments against vouchers, though?
The interesting thing is many of the people that are for vouchers, I don't think they realize what it would actually do. It would bring with it some government regulation. You cannot spend public money without having a regulation. I think a lot of these private school people have an idea that they'll just get free money. That's the way it's going to work. They're already regulated, the religious schools and private schools. So I think there's some real limitations to it. Now, I happen to believe that probably giving more people more options is a reasonable approach, but it's not the only approach. And therefore, it's been rejected because I think fundamentally two reasons. One is there is a general non-support for use of public money, taxpayer money in religious institutions. And secondly, the industry, the school industry, doesn't want competition.
Okay. You're the author of the state's charter school law. What do you make of the way the public school academy movement has taken hold here in Michigan?
It's only about 10% of the students. Some of the schools are terrific schools. And some of them are pretty awful. And I think that this is one area where the charter school people have not really stepped up and shut down bad schools, which was the original model. Governor Engler was very clear when he created charter schools that they were to be experimental, that they were to, some would work and some wouldn't work. But once you create a school, there suddenly becomes, whether it's a traditional public school, as they're called, or a charter school. People want to keep it open, even if it's not working very well. I think we have to do a better job of shutting down bad schools generally.
What makes the good charters good, and what makes the bad charters bad, from your experience?
Security and safety, and the environment. to a large degree. If you can have a, let's say you're talking about the traditional area where charter schools go, urban areas that have difficult environments. They're smaller, they're safer, they create a culture of learning, sometimes better, not always better, but sometimes better than the traditional school model. And I think that's, and then it takes leadership, good teachers, a curriculum that is appropriate for that community. There's all these elements that I think you can identify that make a good school, whether it's a, quote, traditional school or a charter public school, or for that matter, a private school.
Mm-hmm.
Charter schools are just one flavor of public schools. Governments, it's a government-run school, quite heavily regulated.
There is ongoing suspicion of charter schools related simply to the profit motive. How concerned, how vigilant should the public be about this? And is that suspicion? How justified is that suspicion?
Well, to me, it's not a question of profit. It's a matter of, are they delivering the services they're provided? Nobody goes after General Motors for making a profit and selling school buses, or Apple selling iPads. The private sector services are the way we deliver a large part of the services to public education, from electricity and insurance and school buses and lawyer services and school textbooks and uniforms and all kinds of things. Now, we expect our public school authorities to manage those. So the charter schools are authorized and overseen by generally state public university boards. And when they do their job, you don't have to worry about the management company. You do have some problems, I think, of weak boards that have a management company that may be too strong. It's like any public service. We need to make sure the public manages its public resources.
You mentioned the Education Achievement Authority earlier. Do you support the expansion of the EAA?
I support the governor's effort to address the question of these underachieving schools. Don't forget, the EAA, in part, is to carry out the functions of the school code amendments that were adopted under Governor Granholm in a Democratic House of Representatives. It's not a partisan issue, but it's a fear on the education establishment, even when they have failing schools that have failed for 30 years sometimes a school. So it's to take over not more than 50 schools, I believe, is the latest version, and to try to impose new teaching techniques, new management, new structures. So the EAA is one tool that the governor created, and I was pleased to help him to put it together to try to address these. Because at the time we created it, the Detroit Public Schools was about to completely implode. And we have schools all over the state. The real challenge is everybody wants to talk about Detroit. But there's some really failing schools that are failing students all over the state.
What about the now people who resist the expansion of the EAA claim it simply it's only been in operation since September. Shouldn't we wait for more results to be sure this is the
think about an elementary school. If you don't get the students to read by the third, fourth grade, they never learn. This very interesting part, one of the main arguments of the industry is you can't do anything because it's untested and you can't start it and test. And so if you read their rhetoric, this is one of the major arguments. Look, the education establishment has been around for a long, long time, and they have a whole series of arguments to stop change. It's experimental. It hasn't been tested. It doesn't treat everybody. It's unfair. And so we have experimented with schools. Don't forget, charter schools. Exactly the same argument against charter schools. We can't do that. They've never been tried. How can we test them if we don't do it?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just one of the arguments that has some, it's not without some validity, it's untested. Well, I'll tell you, the people running the EAA have a lot of experience, are some really outstanding educators that understand urban schools and urban kids, and they use computer-assisted learning. There's some very exciting ideas in the EAA, and most people, if they went down and visited it and saw it, they would find out what the facts. If you just listen to the rhetoric of the lobbyists, you don't get any real honest picture of it. I'm not sure the EAA has had the resources to tell their own story, but they have a great story. And I have met with them, and they're really trying to do a great job in a very, they got the worst of the worst schools in Detroit to try to turn around. And they're having some success, they're having some challenges. They just replaced two superintendents or principals this week. So, but I think the governor has got, he's willing to take on very tough issues like that.
We're talking with Richard McClellan here this morning on Current State on WKAR. How important is it that more revenue be invested in education in general in the state? Is it important for that figure to go up?
You know, we're going to face a declining enrollment for the next 20 years. And if we continue to decline enrollment and keep spending more money.
We know they're declining enrollment for two decades.
We are going to, for the next 20 years, we're going to have declining enrollment in the public schools of Michigan.
How?
Demographically. Okay. We're getting older, smaller, poorer, and dumber in Michigan. There's a lot of things going on that are going to keep on happening. Everybody knows that. These school superintendents that really in the 60s, 70s, 80s were successful because they built institutions. They built large public schools. They really were skilled at getting property tax. They're now in the business of managing decline, and it's very difficult. We have way too many school districts, and they have a very hard time shutting schools, laying people off, and cutting some of the overhead. So it's a challenge that the existing school districts have, and I think that's why they're so threatened by charter schools, unbundling, online learning. Every one of those things is seen to a threat to a school district that is already facing dramatic challenges.
Let's change the focus here just a little bit. Yeah. You've spent some time monitoring elections in other countries. Tell us a little bit about that experience. Where have you done that and what's it been like?
In 1990, I received a phone call and I said, would I go to Bulgaria for President Bush to see the election? And I said, sure, where is Bulgaria? Well, the next day, I flew off to spend a week in Bulgaria with five or six of us, and we went all over the country meeting with political parties. The Bulgarian government was one of the most slavish devotees of the Soviet Union, but had made a decision to go to the West. They removed their dictator. The Communist Party said, we're going to move to the West. We're going to have a real election. I was fortunate to participate in that. And so that was 1990. 1996, I went back for the presidential election in Bulgaria and saw the changes that can happen in a very short period of time. Bulgaria is now part of NATO. It's part of the European Union. It's dramatically changed. Doesn't mean it doesn't have problems. All those countries have problems. But some people, don't forget, young people today don't even remember the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any idea what that meant. The Iron Curtain and what went on behind the Iron Curtain. So to be part of that was one thing. I also have been, as I think you mentioned, I go to West Africa a lot. And Colin Powell headed up a delegation to one of the Nigerian elections. So I went to Nigeria and spent a week as an official observer of a Nigerian election. I also was involved in representing the transitional government of Somalia, not because they had elections, but they had the United Nations had propped up a government, and I was involved in doing some things not over there, but back here for them.
Does your experience lead you to be encouraged about the expansion of democracy in transitional parts of the world, we'll call them?
Yeah, I think we have to be careful not to be try to impose the American multi-party model. It works a lot of places if it can take place. Clearly, there are some areas where it's one time, one man, one vote, one time. And that we've seen that in some areas where perhaps the Islamists take over. Iran is a good example. They sort of have elections, but only as approved. So, but yes, you're getting some surprising developments of democracy. Look at Myanmar. Really has been moving away by choice. You get other places like Libya. I don't know. Are we going to be able to have any kind of democracy there?
Yeah. What are your thoughts in general about the Arab Spring and the aftermath of the Arab Spring?
Well, I was over in Jordan a couple of years ago, and I spent a lot of time there, and I've talked to people. That's a very risky area. If King Abdullah falls in Jordan, it's going to have some significant. But they're right in the middle of everything: Syria, Iraq, and Israel. I'm going to Israel again this year. Take another to go back again. I've only been there once. I think the Arab Spring is only part of this whole movement of Islam. You may still see a war between the Shias and the Sunnis. Clearly, Egypt hasn't been working very well. They're practically bankrupt. So every day there's some new challenge that we face. I would not want to be in the State Department Middle East group. They're going to be busy in the next few years.
There's a good deal of soul searching in the GOP right now in the aftermath of Mitt Romney's loss. Is the party in need of an overhaul?
Yes, it is. I mean, I'm similar to the libertarian. Conservative. I'm very conservative, but I'm much less willing to impose my views on other people. I have pretty conservative views, but I just don't believe you impose. So there is no question in my mind, say, 10 years from now, people my age will have kind of died off and say same-sex marriage is not going to be an issue in this country. And doesn't mean that people of deeply held religious views will necessarily support it, but the law will permit it. We will recognize other people have different views. Race is still a problem with the Republican Party. There's still some ugliness in both parties. Race is a serious problem. I'm a big fan of immigration for a conservative reason. I believe the economy. We need more talented workers here. Mm-hmm. We don't want to end up like Japan or Europe where we're getting old. We need young people. So the Republicans, from my perspective, they're going to get their act together and change. We've gone through these various periods. I was involved in the campaign with George 43, and they made this gay marriage a very big issue on the campaign because it worked that year. It's amazing how things have changed.
It is incredible.
And if Republicans are going to try to run that kind of campaign again, they're out of date.
How do you think history will regard Rick Snyder's first term?
Well, I think if they step back, I've been around 40 years, I've looked at governors, I'll say this guy in the first year or two did some amazing things in terms of public policy. I mean, as much as people grumble about it, the point is taxing pensions was a critical public policy. And he's just getting pilloried by Republicans and Democrats. But if you've got to have a rational public policy, as we get older and older, if you have a large number of people, they don't pay any taxes. So he did some things that aren't very well known and they aren't very popular. He's also been willing to take on some of these education issues. I think 10 years from now, right to work or freedom to work, as we Republicans call it, will be nobody will ever try to undo it. It's going to happen. There's so few people in the state now that are part of organized labor. And most of my organized labor, I've always known the lobbyists and so on, and we've argued for years. But the truth is they have a disproportionate influence on the public policy of the state than they do on the economy. They do not represent a significant part of the private sector. They do have a huge impact on the public employee section.
Okay. We have to let it go there. I'm sorry to say. Richard McClellan's been our guest here on the first half of Current State. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'd like to have you back.
Be happy to come back. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly joins us in the second half of Current State. We will talk the changes in autism in the state of Michigan, insurance coverage for autism. That's coming up on Current State. Stay with us. I'm Mark Bayshore. its current state. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're hoping you've noticed over the weeks here how much time and planning goes into the music that we air on the show. We take a lot of pride in that. We don't just try to fill up time with the music. Joe Lindstroth, our producer, may know 10 times as much about music as I do, and I thought I knew a lot about music before I met Joe, but boy, I let that one go real fast after I met Joe. But he spends an awful lot of time on this, and we've had actually an awful lot of responses from people through emails and just encounters with listeners and that kind of thing. I really love the music. So in fact, today we're featuring Turkish funk. This is Turkish funk from the 70s. So this is kind of in honor of Richard McClellan being on the show, but we're hoping that it sounds good. We're hoping that you've taken notice of this, and if you are one of those people who have mentioned this to us, check out our Twitter handle, because we're going to start tweeting the actual tracks that you hear on the program at KAR Current State. Okay, that's our Twitter handle, KAR Current State, and we do appreciate the feedback at all times. Our next segment here on Current State is our weekly Tuesday segment that focuses on the Great Lakes. It is produced in conjunction with the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism here at Michigan State University. The dependent relationship between energy and water is an important component of the Great Lakes' energy future. But in this water-rich region, it's a relationship that's easy to overlook. Skip Pruce is a principal at Five Lakes Energy and a former deputy director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Earlier this week, I spoke with Skip about the water-energy nexus. He said the connection between the two is not something to ignore.
There are deep connections, a deep interconnectivity between water and energy, which is really not largely appreciated. We use water in producing all our forms of energy. If you looking at electricity in the Great Lakes region, we have 144 coal plants, and those plants use tens of billions of gallons of water every day. In fact, 76% of all freshwater withdrawals in the Great Lakes region are for thermoelectric generation, for our coal plants, our natural gas plants, and our nuclear plants. So we use a lot of water in producing electricity, and that has consequences.
So are people generally not very aware of the role of water in energy production?
Well, let me connect some of the dots. So when we use that water to produce power, the water is used principally to cool the power plants. And so when that water is discharged after cooling the power plants, it has a temperature that's elevated, and that elevated temperature can affect aquatic communities, ecosystems. It can lower the dissolved oxygen rate. It can produce algae. That's a problem on the Great Lakes. So that's one kind of problem. Another kind of effect associated with water and energy is mercury pollution. So out of the smokestack from these plants in the Great Lakes comes about 13,000 pounds of mercury every year. And that mercury, some of it, is deposited in the lakes, which accounts for our fish advisories that we have that for all of our Great Lakes that we've had for almost three decades. So that's another impact from the nexus of water and energy that people might not realize.
We've also been learning that quite a bit of water is used in hydraulic fracturing recently, right?
Well, that's the thing, and that's a really important issue for the future, because we produce fuels, oil and gas, for a very long time, and with modest amounts of water being used, at least comparatively to the production of unconventional fuels like shale gas from fracking or what is called tight oil from these new oil formations and enhanced oil recovery. So these unconventional means of producing oil and natural gas use much more water than the old methods. And so a fracked natural gas well can use upwards of 20 million gallons of water to produce that natural gas. And that water is then permanently sequestered. Most of it is not recycled. It is permanently sequestered by deep well injection to make sure that it's not a threat to water supplies or our lakes and streams, or so it doesn't contaminate the land. But the point is that those quantities of water are forever gone, no longer available for human use.
Hmm. Now, on the reverse side, not only is water being used up in energy production, but large amounts of energy are being used to treat and move water through pipelines. Tell us about that.
Well, that's true, Mark. Water is heavy. It weighs more than eight pounds per gallon. And so for our water supplies, for your drinking water supply and mine, we are drawing a lot of water in. We're then treating it, and then we have to distribute it through a massive infrastructure. And that uses a tremendous amount of energy. In fact, 4% of all energy, of all electricity, is used to supply water one way or another. In California, where they have to bring water long distances, almost 20% of all electricity use is just for water supply.
So National Geographic's International Energy Agency reports that if current trends continue, the amount of water consumed in producing energy will double by the year 2035. What does that mean for the Great Lakes region exactly?
Well, so here's the really interesting part of all this. We, in the United States, there are 36 states that face really acute, chronic, persistent water shortages. And they're going to have energy needs and increasing energy needs in the future, and they're going to be water constrained. We are water rich in the Great Lakes. In fact, we are globally unique in the availability of fresh water to all of us. And I think that's underappreciated too. 18% of the entire world supply of fresh water surrounds Michigan. So we're water rich, and we don't think about conservation or the use of that water. But we should be setting an example. We should be the best stewards of this globally unique resource, because if we're not, then it's going to be more difficult to protect that water when other states have acute needs that drive them to look at our water and want some of it.
Well, specifically, Skip, how do we become better stewards then?
Well, recently have been a survey of water practices around the country, all 50 states, and Michigan scored a D in that survey. And the reason is because we're so water rich, we haven't done what other states have done. We don't really have conservation measures in place. We don't do water conservation planning. We don't have standards for shower heads and toilets and clothes washers and such. Many other states do. We need to be better stewards of our water supply. Like I said, this exists nowhere else on the planet. And if we don't set an example, then it's going to be difficult for us to say no when others turn to the Great Lakes region and want to build pipelines or otherwise ship our water to other places.
Recently in Michigan, we've started to see lower water levels in the Great Lakes, which are due in part to the changing climate in the region. Assuming climate continues to change in the Great Lakes and across the nation, is demand for water going to more closely resemble that of oil?
Well, so this is such a great point, because we've been talking about water and energy and the interrelationship between those two things. But the interrelationship of climate to water and energy is just really important as well. So with the elevated temperatures, we have greater evaporation in the Great Lakes. In fact, the Great Lakes, we now know, are heat sinks. 92% of the, quote, global warming, unquote, 92% of that heat has gone into our oceans. So very little in the atmosphere, but it's also going in our freshwater lakes. So we're heating the lakes, and there's more evaporation. And so let me give you an example of what that means for Michigan on a local basis. I now live in Leelanau County, which produces cherries and a lot of other fruit. And the reason the climate is so great in Leelanau County for fruit growing is that every year the Grand Traverse Bay would freeze, and the waters in Lake Michigan, at least the near shore waters, would freeze. And that was an agricultural thermometer. Yet that ice kept spring temperatures lower, delaying the buds of the fruit trees, making them less susceptible to late frost. Well, we no longer have that ice. Where in prior decades, the Great Grand Traverse Bay froze every year, it no longer does so. And as a result, the fruit trees are susceptible to the late frost, and we've had two catastrophic killing frosts in the last 10 years. So, you know, that's a direct effect of climate change, which is directly affected by fossil fuel-based electricity production.
I'm curious about renewable energy here. Does renewable energy production require a lot of water?
Well, that's one of the advantages of renewable energy systems. Wind energy, solar, photovoltaic energy doesn't require any water at all, except in the production process to produce the actual equipment. But it doesn't use water, and therefore doesn't have these kinds of effects. Now, there are large solar farms that also rely on cooling water, but in the Southwest, which of the United States, which faces really pretty severe water issues. And so that we'll probably see less of those, but as a general proposition, renewable energy systems avoid the water issues that plague fossil fuel generation and nuclear generation.
Skip Preuss is the principal at Five Lakes Energy. He is the former deputy director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. We've been talking about the water energy nexus in the Great Lakes region. Thanks, Skip.
You're welcome, Mark.
It's Current State. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one in 88 children is diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder, or an ASD, across the nation. Here in Michigan, approximately 16,000 students and 50,000 individuals have an ASD. Last April, Lieutenant Governor Brian Calley signed an autism insurance reform law, making Michigan the 30th state to mandate state-regulated insurance plans offer coverage for autism treatment and diagnosis. The law also provides $15 million in funding for autism insurance providers. Now, on March 18th, the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Autism Council released the Michigan Autism Spectrum Disorders State Plan. Joining us to talk about this, we welcome to Current State Lieutenant Governor Brian Calley. Hi, Brian Calley. How are you?
I'm doing great, Mark. Great to be on the show again.
Thank you. And Jane Turner is a member of the Michigan Autism Council and a professor in the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development here at Michigan State University. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Lieutenant Governor Calley, just tell us a little bit about your experience as a parent of a child with an autism spectrum disorder. What are the challenges involved? What are the difficulties involved?
Well, aside from the behavioral challenges that every family living with autism spectrum disorders faces, just from a daily management standpoint, access to services is, I believe today, the number one issue. And while we've changed the insurance laws, because of the denial of insurance coverage for autism services, behavioral services in particular, there really aren't many providers in Michigan. There's maybe 45 or 50 behavioral therapists in all of Michigan for 16,000 kids and 50,000 adults that have autism. So we've got a long way to go in development of that network. But the exciting thing is it's really starting to happen. Our universities are starting to really ramp up their programs that create behavioral therapists. And we've got some others that went elsewhere for looks. Some young folks that graduated college in this field went elsewhere to look for a career and are coming back to Michigan now. So this activity is really exciting.
You have such a personal stake in this legislation. Talk to us about that. You must feel personally connected to this issue.
This is an area where, you know, I've got a daughter who's 6 years old and she has autism. And as you can probably imagine, somebody in a position like mine, even with all the challenges, was able to find behavioral therapy for my daughter. But the average person had no chance at all. And so it was really important for me to step up and take a leadership role in taking the experience that I had and using it for those thousands of families out there that have struggled through it, and it really is something else. Everywhere I go, I get stopped by parents of kids with autism more than any other subject for any other purpose, whether I'm at an airport or I'm at the store or right now I'm up in Mackinac, of course, with a bunch of people here for the Light the Bridge Blue for Autism Awareness Month here in Mackinac. But it's really a wonderful experience to be a part of this transformation that we have going on in Michigan right now.
April is Autism Awareness Month then.
That's right. April is Autism Awareness Month, and today, April 2nd, is Global Autism Awareness Day.
Okay.
And so we're lighting the Mackinac Bridge blue, and with all the cable lights have been switched out, money privately raised, sponsored by DTE Energy. And this is it'll be a great statement that the state of Michigan is really serious about dealing with autism spectrum disorders.
Jane Turner, let's get a little more context on autism spectrum disorders. Can you talk about that from 5 miles up?
Sure, yes, thanks. Autism spectrum, it is a spectrum of disorders, meaning some individuals are very severely touched by the disorder and others may be more mildly touched by the disorder. In essence, there are three major areas of difficulty for individuals with autism. One is in communication, language delay or communication disorder. Another is in social interactions. And the third major area of difficulty is in repetitive or stereotypical behavior. So what does that mean? An individual with a classic autism will have significant difficulty in language, may not be verbal at all, have difficulties interacting with other individuals, have difficulties not sharing attention with others or being able to interact, because some individuals who have a speech disorder or a language disorder can still interact with you, but an individual with autism has having trouble in both of those, and then repetitive behaviors, stereotypical behaviors, doing the same thing over and over, or a very intense interest in one thing and nothing else can catch their interest. And that also translates into great difficulty in transitions, in making a transition from saying playing inside to let's play outside. Any change in routine can be very difficult. That's on one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum would be someone who has the diagnosis of Asperger's disorder, in which the communication disorder isn't as great. They may have normal language, but may use language a little differently than other folks, and will have problems with social interactions, and then some very limited interest, some certain things that are intensely interesting and other things that are not. So there's a wide spectrum, and every individual, of course, is an individual, has different issues, but those are the three major problems for children and adults with autism.
Lieutenant Governor Calley suggested that the shortage of therapists is one of the really towering challenges here. Would you agree with him on that score?
I certainly do agree with him on that score. I think that the last count, there's somewhere around 40 certified behavioral analysts in the state. We have been training, as he mentioned, we do have training programs here in the state, and those individuals that have graduated from, say, Eastern Michigan University or Western have been moving out of state. We also have, as he mentioned, there's good news on the horizon. Michigan State is starting a certificate program, a graduate certificate program will be launched in the fall in the College of Education for people to be then eligible for a certification. So we're working on that. It's not the only deficit we have. We also don't have enough individuals. We don't have enough multidisciplinary teams to do the evaluation and make the diagnosis. Right now, for children to be able to access the services, someone, a qualified team needs to make the diagnosis. And we have just a few centers around the state that have pulled that together. We have the individuals. We need to get them coordinated, working together, as well as train more people to do that.
What's at the heart of the training of a really good therapist or behavioral clinician here for someone with autism? What's at the heart of their skill set?
Wow, that's a tough question because I'm a pediatrician and I don't know how to do applied behavior analysis, which is what it is. So you're kind of taking me outside of my area. The Lieutenant Governor may be able to answer that one better because he's working with a behavior analyst with his daughter.
Brian Calley, any response to that?
That's the hard part, Mark, is because it's experience. And so if somebody decides that they want to go into this field, there's an education process, and there's a few different types of undergraduate programs or degrees you can go through that are relevant that help you get started. But really what it comes down to is literally thousands of hours working with a professional in this field. So it's like other medical professions like nursing, where sure, you go through and get formal education, but then you have to spend clinical hours actually doing the job with somebody who's a mentor or in a residency or tutor type situation. And so it's not a fast process in getting people from where they're at today to qualify to deliver this service.
Hmm. That sounds worrisome here. How long do you think it may take? I mean, has anyone looked at how long it might take to get up to a more effective place in terms of the number of clinicians involved?
When we looked at other states that passed the autism insurance reform laws, because that's the first step. See, people won't go into a field where you can't get paid. So once you make the economics around providing the service work, then you just have to go through a process of getting people here that are qualified to deliver the service. Other states are experiencing that at a rate of about 3 to 5 years from the passage of the autism insurance reform. We're determined to do better than that. We have an autism state plan. Now we have universities already up and running that are just expanding their programs, Eastern and Western, as Dr. Turner mentioned, and then also Michigan State University, U of M, and Oakland University, all involved in various aspects of it as well and ramping up what they're doing. And so when you consider the resource of the universities that we have in Michigan today and the fact that we have trained a lot of these professionals that went to other states to find work, I think we have a leg up on the competition. So we're aggressively trying to get these professionals back in our state and train people here. And so we're determined to beat that 3 to 5 year estimate that other states have experienced.
Jane Turner, what difference does early diagnosis make?
Oh, early diagnosis makes a huge difference because the intervening earlier, providing the services early, you get much more, a much better outcome than if you delay it, provide the services later. And we have a long way to go, not just in Michigan, but across the country and really around the world. Right now, I think the average age of diagnosis of autism is age 4. And the diagnosis can be made in most cases before age 2, and in fact, in many cases, even earlier than that, at 12 months or 18 months. You get much better outcome. You get more improvement in the child's functioning if you work with them early. So very important that we move that diagnosis down.
And what do Michigan's changes here mean for kids who don't have autism but have some other neurodevelopmental disorder?
Well, that's a good question, and that's a major question that came up when this legislation was coming forward. There was a fair amount of controversy about that. Are we going to focus on autism and neglect children with other neurodevelopmental disorders? Are we going to get so focused that we're going to be doing less for the others? I think, and in the autism state plan, it states this also, by working on our systems of care for individuals with ASD, we will be improving our systems of care and our early recognition of other developmental disorders and providing interventions for children with other disorders, though they may not specifically get be qualified for the applied behavior analysis for autism. So it does give us an opportunity to improve our, not even an more than an opportunity, it forces us to improve our systems of care. And we're already seeing that. We're seeing children who are being evaluated for autism, and then they don't have autism, but they are getting access to other services to approach their diagnosis.
Very good. We got to leave it there. Jane Turner's a member of the Michigan Autism Council. We want to thank Lieutenant Governor Brian Calley for also joining us. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we speak with MSU economist Charlie Ballard about the State of the State survey. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, Gabriella Saldivia, and Sonia Treewiler for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.